You're listening to the Unsung Podcast, where we talk about albums that we think are unsung classics, and then you guys tell us if you're right or wrong. This is the Unsung Podcast. Welcome to episode 40 of the Unsung Podcast. On last week's episode, we were talking about Ignoto by Your Codename Is Milo, and the public have decided that it does not make it into our discography. So thank you very much to everybody who listened and to everybody who voted. On this episode, we're talking about Who Kill by Tune Yards. Hi, you're listening to the Unsung Podcast. I am your host, Mark Fraser, and I am joined by two men who literally just before we went on air decided to form a Chaz and Dave tribute band.
Too soon. Am I Chaz or am I Dave? Which one died?
You are Dave.
I am Dave. Does that mean I'm still alive?
Yes.
I used to register my name whenever I got pirated software. I would falsely put my name down as Chaz Kozak.
Well, there you are.
What's happening? So it seems like Mark has been tracking our movements.
Well, I'm sorry to say that you've died. to my right, Glasgow's most handsome ghost.
And gone to Patter Heaven.
Chris Cusack. Chaz Cusack.
And across the room from me, somewhat to my left, I guess, Glasgow's loneliest Dave, missing his partner in folky crime. What did Chaz and Dave even play, actually? I don't really know.
Like Cockney folk English shit.
How's your father?
You got a beautiful chin. You got beautiful skin. You got a beautiful face.
Slap your knee, kid. Slap your knee core.
Oh, fucking like E.T. Niels. I literally don't know.
Sounds like advert music. Or like Minder.
Do you remember Minder?
Was that the one with... Who was in Minder?
Arthur. Arthur Daly.
Oh, no, I don't remember it. I remember seeing it on like clip shows and thinking, that looks very depressing.
You don't remember Boone either?
No, I have no idea
Boone
what that is.
So Boone and Minder are missing from your...
I was too young for Minder.
Experience
you
reservoir.
You're the same age.
Your British pop culture experience reservoir. That means that your reservoir is actually somewhat less depressing than everybody else's.
Well, yeah,
which
exactly.
Maybe goes to explain why you wear so many salmon and pink tops.
This is not... I mean...
This is the same one you wore last week.
Same one I wore last week. I don't think I've even washed it. No.
I guess we're doing a record this week, right?
Oh, well, in a change from every other week, yeah.
That's why we're here.
I think before we go any further, just want to put a shout out at the start of the programme. We got some sad news this week at the passing of a very fine musician and a friend of a lot of friends, Dale Barclay of the band The Amazing Snakeheads from Glasgow. Dale died at a tragically young age of 32. And I know a lot of people up here are feeling it just now. So if you haven't heard The Amazing Snakeheads, please do. And
their album, Amphetamine Ballads, is a very angry, righteous, unique piece of music. Mm-hmm. So I think you should definitely check it out if you haven't heard it.
Yeah, and our thoughts and prayers to friends of Dale and his family. That said... Yes, we're going to do a record this week, Mark. Well done.
Yay!
Fine observation. Right up there with some of your best.
Fellow Chaz and Dave.
We were getting a lot of praise for bullying you.
I don't think it's... Is it really bullying? I don't know.
Do you feel bullied?
No.
If he doesn't feel
maybe
it,
in denial.
Yeah, I'm in denial about it, yeah.
Yeah. Remember earlier on online when we said to Mark, we're going to bully you extra hard this week, and he said, I set this up, I'll leave.
I wasn't being
serious.
He
responded with an appropriate amount of concern.
I did not. I wasn't being serious, obviously, I'm still here.
I notice you're holding a wet tissue though.
So. I have a cold. I think I've got the cold that you guys had like 2 weeks ago.
Then those aren't tears.
Those are not tears, no.
Right, okay.
Sadly.
Well, I believe you.
Just getting ready to cry.
This week, the record is of my choosing, and it is by Tuneyards. Spelled small t, big U, small n, big e, hyphen, small y.
That's not spelled. I mean, it's spelled Tuneyards.
Capital A.
You're talking about stylized. It's stylized.
Large d, small s. Sorry, David, you were saying?
That's not the spelling of it. That's just the fucking... Well, that's the capitalization. It's the stylization.
And he's a big corn fan, so he knows the difference between...
Is it the syntax of it?
Before.
I mean, you'd say corn is spelled with a K, but it's stylized with a... capitalized R if you can't get the backwards one. Anyway, sorry.
Don't bully me, I'm not Mark. Something to get off your chest, take it out on him.
Why did you pick this record? Did you hear it in a Starbucks coffee shop?
Excuse me, the album's title is spelled W space H space O space K space I space L space L, presumably no space, although there could be.
We just don't know.
We don't know how many spaces are after it. Very rare.
So many, yeah.
Yeah. Who Kill.
Who Kill.
That's so cool.
It was originally titled Women Who Kill, apparently. But I think that was considered a little bit too gender specific for the band as they were, especially seen as their, what's that website? Wikipedia.
Oh, Wikipedia.
Is it pains to avoid any gender pronouns? Uh-huh. So I think the name was adjusted with that in mind. And indeed, Merrill Garbus, who ostensibly is Tuneyards, or at least certainly started it, it was just her. She's since been joined by her musical life partner, as David informs me, Nate Brenner.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
that's correct.
That is his name.
Merrill Garbus is a very gifted and interesting person. And I'm going to just get right out in front of this and say, I was frankly astonished to find out that Merrill Garbus wasn't black when I first investigated her back yon. But we'll touch on that.
Well, yeah, but I mean, she talks about that quite openly.
At length,
mm. Yeah.
It's about white privilege, is it not?
She also talks about her white privilege.
Yeah, I know.
It's good to be back here so soon on the topic of cultural appropriation.
It's bloody but ideal, isn't it?
Yeah. Weeks after
Sage. Welcome to Sage. Unsung Racial Podcast, where we discuss
three white men,
cultural issues.
No right to talk about.
I don't think we have no right. I just
people don't, shouldn't listen. That's what you think.
Yeah, exactly.
Don't bully we can Dave. Talk about them, but for God's sake, switch off.
Don't listen to me.
Don't bully Dave.
Look, we're trying to spread it around. If you'd like us to redouble our efforts back on you, then I'm more than happy because you don't really fight back much.
So
I don't care, that's why.
Chris, why did you choose this record? When did you first come across this album?
This is one of the purest musical choices I've made. Okay, like I find it really hard to decontextualize records in general, as you've probably learned.
You find it hard to decontextualize most things in life, Chris.
Including that comment, David.
Yeah, exactly. I know.
I kind of went with it because it's musically a very, very good record, and it's musically a very innovative record. It's got lots of cool ideas. It's really well produced. It's good to dance to. It's fun. It's really stands out, I think, musically. Having been forced to scrutinize this record for the program has left me with far more mixed feelings about it and about the artist.
Mm-hmm.
But musically, I totally stand by it. I think it's a really good album. It's definitely the best thing that Tuneyards have done. And I think what Tuneyards do, generally speaking, is extremely interesting and worthy of attention. What did, Dave, I know you were familiar with it. Mark, had you heard this before?
I had not heard it before, no.
And do you have any kind of newbie reactions?
It left me very cold.
Okay.
I can appreciate it as a work of music. I think it is very musically interesting. I think the production's wonderful on it, frankly. But I was left thinking, these people are very talented, and Meryl knows how to put a song together really well in a really creative and interesting way, but so what? I don't care. I was left feeling very cold by it, and I listened to it a few times, and I was like, there's no hook for me here.
David?
They're a band that I have consistently heard my friends play, like, sort of gone on in the van or the car, and I go, oh, that's cool, I really like that. Who is it again? And it's Tune Yards, and then later on, I'll go and I'll stick the album on and I'll listen to it and I'll just go, oh, it's not grabbing me like it grabbed me when I didn't know what it was. Yeah, quite similar to Mark. I've consistently attempted Tune Yards and I understand them. I think there's a lot of really interesting things going on. A lot of really nice things happening on this album. You know, there's some really interesting melodies. I like our lyrics. The production is great. There's lots of interesting ideas, you know, weaving in, weaving out.
Weaver.
But yeah, exactly. Really connected me with me on a spiritual level. But it's of a genre that has never captured my attention.
What you don't really care for.
What genre would you say it is? I struggle to place
it. I would call it American indie wank.
I'm pretty sure there's a card for that in your local HMV.
Yeah. So
is that there's
like
the Starbucks
like,
indie?
Like, yeah, you know, there's stuff like Animal Collective, Grizzly Bear, all these, you know, highly lauded Pitchfork artists from the late 2000s.
I definitely agree. I mean, she's on Pitchfork's like live festival every goddamn year.
And you know, it's interesting and really talented musicians doing things that just don't quite interest me enough. I really appreciate that they're adding wonky structures and weird melodies and, you know, think, you know, a lot of global influences to pop music.
That is a nice way to put it.
Yeah. In other words, they appropriate many cultural influences. There's just something in the final product to me. I don't know. It has no, I can't even think of the word. It just has no grab for me. It doesn't click. There's no danger to it.
No danger. Well, that's an interesting choice of words, I guess.
And you know, there's music like this has to be really fucking good. There's got to be something weird to it for me to be interested to it, interested in it. And I don't know what it is. A lot of my friends fucking love Tune Yards, and a lot of my friends love, you know, specific bands like this. And then there's only a few of them that I ever grab onto. I think Dirty Projectors, there's a lot of similarity.
Yeah, they're kind of compared to them quite a bit. She will break through. Nobody stops her. No one can lock her down. She is a epiphany of a
relentlessity. Opens my days like she always. And I, for some reason, I get a lot more from Dirty Projectors. There's also a band called Wild Birds and Peace Drums. Don't know if you've heard them.
I haven't.
So they had a few records before this and a few records after. They're like a much sparser version of this, just, you know, basically that female vocal and percussion. But there's something about that that is much more attention grabbing for me.
I think
yeah, it's really interesting. There's a lot going on here, and it's a really nice musical record, and I think throughout their career their albums have been interesting. But I'm like Mark, it just doesn't, nothing grabs me.
It's very High Fidelity, isn't it? Something I can imagine, like, the guy in High Fidelity really fucking loving and recommending in his music store.
I mean,
you know,
I think you guys both know by now that I'm no great fan of the kind of Pitchfork hype machine type approach to bands. Mm-hmm. And I think you're right to observe that Tune Yards are very much one of those bands. When you look them up online, so many of their live sessions and videos are all the usual suspects that they're involved in. I do think, however, that they are an exception to the rule that so many of those bands I do find quite flat and quite unremarkable. I think Tune Yards as a whole struggle to realise what they're going for.
Yeah.
But I think that's also kind of slightly more down to some complicated socio-political factors that we'll maybe discuss in a minute. This album, as a distillation of what they're going for, I think works very well. I think it's really important off the bat to just see how fantastically well produced it is.
Yeah, but that was the first thing that jumped out at me on it.
Have you listened to it with headphones on at all?
All the time.
But funnily enough, you know, the first record, Bird Brains, is the opposite in that it's, you know, it was recorded
on a handheld recorder.
Yeah. And I like that record as well. There's something really nice about it's got that background hum to it. You're just hearing it, you know, played as it is. Yeah. So although the production on this is fantastic and, you know, makes things, you know, really, really clear, I don't know if that's...
Well, but like this came out in 2011. Bird Brains was in like 2009, I think it got its proper release, because she originally recorded it and released it on cassette, like overdubbing it onto cassettes in a kind of bespoke way. And then it was picked up by 4AD and 4AD remastered and re-released it. It was recorded on a handheld recorder and sort of looped up and pieced together that way. Bird Brains is actually surprisingly good, considering that's how it was done. The second track in it, Sunlight, I think actually sounds really, really good. The song called Hatari as well, that's pretty successful. And Hatari hints at that kind of vocal, very African-style scales and the African-style guitar that goes on to become a feature of this. I think Bird Brain was even mixed on like shareware, you know, just free downloaded shareware. So it's all a very DIY aesthetic. With this one, obviously a lot of time and effort was spent on that production. The use of the stereo image in this is brilliant. Contrapuntal guitar lines go from left to right to accentuate them. Nate Brenner had come on for this, so originally it was just Meryl Garbus on her own, and Nate had joined, and I think he became involved in the songwriting, not for all of it by any means, but certainly for a fair bit, and that seemed to kind of propel them to a slightly higher fidelity place. Obviously they had the budget of 4AD at their disposal as well. Also, there's actually a bit in Bird Brains that I think is worth listening out for, in the song called Jamaican, which is a problematic song, like so much a Tune Yards stuff, ironically, given that they're so incredibly progressive. They do stumble into problematic territory quite a lot, but Jamaican has a really cool touch in it to emphasize its kind of lo-fi credentials, where there's a sampled cough, there's a loop going in the background, a percussive loop, and one of the percussive elements is a cough, which was a really cool touch. They've really struggled, I think, to replicate what they did in this, and it goes to that observation we made recently about trying to bottle lightning. They followed up an album called Nicky Knack in 2014. He tried to tell me that I had a right to sing just like a bird has to fly, and I wanted to believe him because he seemed like a really nice guy. Oh, but I trip on the truth when I walk that wire. By that point, they'd kind of expanded the band. They toured with Arcade Fire. It did receive some praise. Spin.
I think it was pretty well reviewed overall.
It's hit and miss. Like Spin said, it betters Who Kill with more sophisticated chops, and NME had said it was easily their finest work. But the likes of Consequence of Sound had called it clunky, a record fraught with lyrical flubs.
flubs, that's a good word.
Yeah, and Noisy had written quite an extensive article saying that Tune Yards had finally become too quirky for our own good. Moments of pure brilliance, but not often enough. Words and arrangements that made them cringe. Songs meander with too many ideas stuffed into too little space. And I have to be honest, I tend to agree with that analysis of that album. I think it's quite contrived, and I think they've really attempted, a bit like the LaRue thing, a bit, they've really attempted to try and synthesize what came together on their previous album, their second album, the one that we're discussing.
Yeah, it's difficult to try and be weird. Mm-hmm. You have to just be weird.
Yeah. I mean, there's a song called Water Fountain on Nicky Knack, which was picked up for a Google Pixel advert and ended up becoming one of their better known tunes, and you see them performing it in a lot of shows. There's some really difficult moments on it as well, though. There's a track called Real Thing, ironically, which is, it's kind of a bit of a kind of cheesy, sort of slightly cringy jazz pop thing that has a line in it, which is, "I come from the land of slaves, let's go Redskins, let's go Braves." And aside from the fact that some people said this, you know, is there much meaning to that phrase, or are you just trying to make it rhyme for the sake of it? Like, is that a bit flippant for such a heavy subject? It's also just part of a pattern that Tune Yards display of dropping in subtle little kind of dog whistly hints of clearly black music. Like, and I don't mean, I mean, most music's black music, but I mean, like, contemporary black music, African music, Haitian music, especially West African music seems to be a big ingredient. There's also a track called Left Behind on that album, which is the line, "We said we wouldn't let them take our soil," which, given that, you know, she was born in New England, mm-hmm. was like a puppeteer in Vermont, by all accounts had a reasonably normal middle class upbringing.
Yeah,
it's fine to sing about those things. Absolutely, it's fine to sing about those things. But I think you have to
at it from a particular angle.
Exactly. And I think Tune Yards have suffered from their lack of tact. I think initially people were just very impressed musically, and then obviously they happened to arrive at a point when everybody was becoming quite woke, and that has unavoidably, unfortunately for them, but unavoidably become a big part of their legacy. They were one of the main focuses, despite being clearly quite left to centre themselves. She's very androgynous. Mm-hmm. I might add, I'm comfortable saying she, because there was a quote I found which said, "As a white cisgendered woman in a heteronormative relationship, I'm pretty safe in this society." So despite the lack of gender pronouns on Wikipedia, I'm going to opt for that for the time being. If we're wrong, please
send us hate mail.
Please publicly shame us online.
Every interview I've read have used her and she. So
There is definitely some dubiety over it, because in early interviews she was quite non-committal about it, and clearly whoever set up the Wikipedia and maintained it, from I'd assume the label or her management, was also at lengths to try and avoid that. But that's become a big feature of them. So when eventually they released the fourth album in 2018, which is called I Can Feel You Creep Into My Private Life, immediately it was apparent that the elephant in the room could no longer be ignored. There are a few tracks in particular, but I mean, the album itself is a bit more electronic. It's kind of loungy, for want of a better word, sounds a lot whiter.
I think this record sounds very white, personally.
This one?
Yeah.
The one that doesn't sound white?
I think it sounds very white. I think it sounds like a white person trying very hard to appropriate black culture. Ironically makes it sound even whiter than
it is. I have to say, I was like Chris in that when I first heard it. And like that first lyric on the whole album is, "My country, tis of thee, sweet land of liberty, how come I cannot see my future within your arms." And I thought she was a black woman singing that. Yeah. And I was like, I'm getting into this.
It's not explicitly black, but it's a dog whistle-y sort of, it sounds like there's a racial or disenfranchised context to it. And there is, she's a woman, so she's entitled to, but it just, all the other elements, I mean, there is a massive number of appropriated, and I'm trying to make that quite a neutral use of that word, appropriated influences from, as I said, West African,
no question about
Haitian
it,
Haitian and stuff. I'll go into that in a wee bit of detail in a minute, but as regards this cultural appropriation thing, it became very much a feature of that fourth album. Needle Drop had done a review of it, and aside from the review of the fourth album being quite scathing,
are you actually going to quote Needle Drop right now? A guy who is quite alt-right.
Go on.
He's got an alternate persona online on YouTube at one point. Which,
what's his name again?
I can't remember his name, but it was a whole lot of kind of lampooning of the left, and you know, having a lot of alt-right content, and then
Anthony Fontano.
Yeah, and then it started to seep into the Needle Drop, which is obviously a completely separate channel, and he was one that's behind this other alt-right channel, and it caused him to lose quite a lot of subscribers because of it. I just thought it was a really interesting point to bring that up if we're talking about cultural appropriation and stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, it probably, that's relevant to his criticisms of this album. I mean, many of his criticisms of this album are purely based on the music. He seems like he's somebody that really liked the earlier work, but in this, aside from the fact that he finds it quite dull and quite sterile, I think is one of the words he used in particular. There's a lot of observations of the kind of racial considerations that just are peppered throughout the album. I mean, his perspective and his reputation elsewhere notwithstanding, I think he does make some pretty interesting points. He talks about it sounding a bit like Seller's Remorse, given that it follows the claims of cultural appropriation that were thrown at the band. He questions, why are you turning the car around at this late stage, given that you can't possibly have not realised what you were doing for three albums? And I think that is a fair point. Mm-hmm. Given the regularity and the significance of the moments of black music that are in this, she can't possibly have taken until her fourth album to become aware of what was going on. And it certainly didn't take until 2018 for that to become a cultural issue. Mm-hmm. It was a cultural issue back in the 60s. I mean, clearly we live in a time where it's very much the zeitgeist. And he'd also said,
She literally said it came to a point where she couldn't not speak about whiteness in her work. And what I noticed was that every interview that they had and she had about that fourth album early this year mentioned, whiteness, white privilege. You know, Tune Yards have made a record about white privilege, and it's really great. When I saw that, and when I saw, every single headline on every single one, it was like they are overtly, trying to cover themselves right now. Obviously she's artistically gone in there and done that, but then the record label are like, right, that's the fucking selling point. Sell it on this white privilege.
Congratulatory just, almost.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's like, oh, she's so self-aware of how, she's done that for the last three records and not mentioned it, that it's incredible. This fourth record is so woke, it's unreal. Whereas it's like, oh no, she was actually quite unwoke for the first three records.
Yeah, I mean, I think, his other reputations notwithstanding, the Needle Drop guy makes the point of, like, when did we confuse genuine concern and allyship with just demonstrations of self-flagellation?
Yeah.
And there is something a little bit, I don't know, I mean, it was easy to find press about this, and all the press around that album, as you said, was coming from the point of, she's not looking for forgiveness, she's looking to learn, she's looking to be educated. There's something, oh my god, painfully fucking West Coast liberal about the way that she embarked upon it. I don't know if you noticed that she
attended a 6-month anti-racist workshop.
Buddhist workshop.
Yeah. Why would you even need to do that as a decent human being?
It's called White and Awakening in Sangha. And she did that in January 2017. It was like a Buddhist-led seminar to help participants, quote, gain insight into the suffering that arises from a racial conditioning.
And do you know what? At some point, the more we talk about this, I'm also like, well, she's in a lose-lose situation, isn't she? Because she just wants to make music. She loves African music, so, what her influences, they are exactly that. They're going to influence her output. So she's just making the music that she wants to make. And then if she acknowledges that, then she's this, do-good lefty hippie. And if she doesn't, then she's a unwoke idiot. So I do get that point, and I feel like I don't want to be a sort of SJW about it.
Yeah, I mean, I totally get that. And to be honest, I'm actually quite neutral on the subject. It's just...
It's interesting.
It's interesting, and it doesn't sit particularly well. There's little bits and bobs about it. Her use of language, like the song Doorstep is like a first-person song about police violence.
Yeah, I think there are definitely things.
Tone deaf, I think, is the correct way to put it.
Again, killer, gangsta, power. It's very... Yeah. black turns on the language. The song ABC, she's got a line in it which is, "All I know is white centrality." And that's the flip. That's when she went to this thing of like this self-flagellation. There was a comparison drawn with Macklemore. And his sort of contrition for being white in the face of cultural appropriation in hip hop, which obviously we spoke about. That album that he did to This Unruly Mess I've Made was an attempt to discuss and apologise for like musical appropriation, but just kind of ended up, based on a lot of reviews as well, kind of coming across as kind of dull and morose and a bit self-serving. And it was like an epic track in that called White Privilege 2, which was just dross.
You toy with the culture was never yours to make better. Your Miley, your Elvis, your Iggy Azalea. Make it so plastic, you've heisted the magic. You've taken the drums and the accent, you wrapped in your brand of hip hop is so fascist and backwards. The Grandmaster Flash that go slappy, you bastard. All the money that you made off the water.
It was really just him, you know, expunging these, you know, guilty hand-wringing moments they had. And she'd actually observed in interviews, she was like, she was quoted as saying, Macklemore is on the defensive, how do I not go there whilst doing this fourth album? But I think in effect she kind of does. Mm-hmm. The album doesn't end up being a much of a musical triumph. There's a couple of tracks, Now As Then, and a track called Honesty, both kind of do their bit to reflect on like institutionalized racism and white identity. The main one is a track called Colonizer, which is sort of the thematic centerpiece of that fourth album. And it has a series of lyrics that are, I use my white woman's voice to interpret my travels with African men. I turn on my white woman's voice to contextualize acts of my white women friends. I cry my white woman's tears. Yet she had a white touring band. She clearly put on what was quite a heavily accented black voice for someone from New England. Even in the fact that with her touring band, they used face paint and stuff, which whether we as white people care to admit it, unless we're Picts, is a very traditionally African thing. And yet it seemed slightly parodic. You know, it just, yeah. There's some, and I think, yeah, there's not a lot of things she can do. She can't take that back. But I do think it's hard to believe in retrospect that she was unaware of it, or she must have been incredibly naive to be unaware of that up until that point. One of the interviews with her, I noticed that said, these are her sins as a white person in this world, and she's working to be better. And that is just, that sentence is the kind of sentence that fucking just sends people running to the fucking ballot box to vote for Donald Trump. I totally get it, but there is a level of naivety combined with overbearing white self-flagellation that just goes around it. So I just think that whole atmosphere clouds this band and has kind of determined their career, because as good as this album as Who Kill Is, the album that obviously I picked because something that we've hardly mentioned it, as good as this album is, they veered away from it, and a lot of its best moments came from it. A lot of its finest and most interesting ideas were very distinctly black in origin. Hello, peeps. Sorry to interrupt your enjoyment. We need to ask you for some cash, please. We're going to do a bonus episode soon. So if you contribute cash to really any amount, you'll get access to that bonus episode. And it will be hilarious because we're going to make an extra effort to get half cut before we record it.
Yeah, we need to do it in a couple of weeks because I'm not drinking for 2 weeks. But then once we do it, I will really, truly drink.
Yeah, the jams will be kicked right the fuck out. And we also were trying to do some stuff regarding hosting and sponsoring some of these posts to try and get a little bit further. And goodness knows, we need to get more money to Mark Zuckerberg soon because the boy's really struggling after that share price took a tumble. Also, Brexit beckons and things are going to get tough over here at Unsung Heights. Anybody in this room vote for Brexit? There you go. So please go to unsungpod.net/donate. You know, any amount. What works for you works for us, and we will reimburse you to the tune of
Patter.
Patter. Maybe even drunk patter.
Yeah.
Thanks. Back to the show. actually feel like to do a bit of justice to that as well, because one of the problems is with Tune Yards, you can hear there are black influences, yet so few attempts are made to actually convey where these influences came from. You're platforming them in one way, but you're kind of not. I mean, she even described somebody stopping on the street once and saying they'd been listening to Haitian music and it sounded so much like Tune Yards. Mm-hmm. And she was like, that's exactly the wrong way around. Tune Yards sounds like Haitian music as opposed to Haitian music sounding like Tune Yards. So I kind of felt it was appropriate for us, you know, we're platforming this album, to maybe platform some of the places that she got her influences from in African music as well. So, and please, this is like the ultimate sketchy guide.
Chris Cusack's guide to African music. I literally never thought I'd see the day.
I never thought those pods would ever be spoken by another human being.
I can only apologise.
All around the world,
to the entirety of
whose
Africa.
Ears are burning right now.
We have fans in Africa. You better watch your step, pal.
All right, guys.
Okay, so Dearn food.
Okay, so obvious touchstones here are Afrobeat. Okay, that's like the most blatant and the most commonly cited in when reviews were making any kind of acknowledgement of the African roots. Afrobeat was actually started by a Nigerian musician called Fela Kuti. Excuse me if I get any pronunciations wrong, but
I'm white and ignorant.
I'm the whitest guy in the room at the best.
Fela Kuti is correct.
Who died actually quite young, a really influential African musician. Nigeria and Ghana were sort of the Afrobeat HQ for a long time. Funk and jazz merged with a style called Fuji that I'll get to. Bands like Vampire Weekend, even tracks like Once in a Lifetime by Talking Heads, they've drawn a lot of influences from that sort of stuff. And then there's Afropop, which is a slightly more contemporized, better produced version of that. There are some other interesting styles kicking around in Nigeria, especially the Bikutsi, there's Benga Beat. One of the most fascinating ones is Fuji, which actually kind of became known as Fuji Garbage. It's kind of strange, but a guy called Sekiru Ayinde Barrister is probably the best known pioneer of this. Along with his contemporary and it seems bitter rival, Gekko Collington Ayinla. They'd released a lot of like really interesting music with Fuji, and Fuji went on to form like the core of Afrobeat. There's a track called Reality by Sekiru Ayinde Barrister, which really shows the kind of brass bursts and the percussive parallels that it holds with Tune Yards. But that stuff, more than a lot that I listen to, really, you can definitely hear a lot of that. There's a style called High Life, which originated in Ghana. Which kind of was a contemporized version of a thing called Akan, where they took that music and they adapted it to Western instruments. Tune Yards obviously is played on quite traditional Western music, snare drums, normal drum kits, synthesizers. She uses a ukulele heavily, but there's also guitar and guitar through distortion pedals. But a lot of what they're playing is very, very similar to what would have been played on much more traditional instruments. There was a little bit of like controversy. I think she took a trip to Haiti at one point, and people were a little bit critical of it as being somewhat, when I say tourism, obviously it was tourism to an extent, but being something of a fact-finding mission as well. And that Haitian music kind of blends a lot of the people who settled there, which was kind of like a mixture of French, Spanish and African. It's quite an interesting melting pot as a result. There was a band called Taboo Combo, who are pretty well known from Haiti, and they've got quite a kind of Spanish sound, but definitely with a bit more of the vibrancy of African rhythms. Don't see me to a cuenta para concha, ya voy. There's a really interesting one called Sanba Zhao. I'm not entirely sure how to pronounce that. It's S-A-N-B-A-Z-A-O. And that was much more what the three of us as white males might associate with African music. That the influence is shone through a lot stronger than that. It was actually it was really quite accessible. Rhythmically, it was really complicated and interesting. You know, Tuneyard sets up a lot of polyrhythms using a looper pedal, and it's quite a fascinating technique. And Sanba Zhao seems to do a lot of it himself, just with very intricate playing. Also from Haiti, you had things like Zouk and Compa, which is like a modern version of merengue, and kind of you hear a lot of that in and around the Caribbean as well. I think she also seemed to take quite a lot of influence from places like Senegal. There's a style of music, now, forgive me, M-B-A-L-A-X, Mbalax. Give that a shot.
Yeah.
Mbalax. Who actually, one of the biggest proponents of Mbalax is a guy called Youssou N'Dour. You know where you get that name? Do you recognise the name?
Oh, yes. Did a song with Nina Cherry, Seven Seconds. But he's also just a fucking amazing musician.
Yeah, he's brilliant. You
know, that was like his prize. Western hit, but he's fucking great.
Exactly. And that's kind of characterised by some quite frantic percussion. Even Harder is a South African genre. It's spelled M-B-A-Q-U-A-N-G-A, Bakwanga, I think. And yeah, it's kind of South African Zimbabwean. And actually, that is the one that seems to have most informed the likes of Graceland by Paul Simon. And Graceland's an album that actually experienced a lot of the same criticisms, albeit in a more culturally naive time when it wasn't such an issue to culturally appropriate. But certainly Graceland is one that has aged strangely when you apply a modern lens to it. You know, when you look at Graceland in the context now of white people just stealing black ideas and remarketing them, albeit Graceland, Paul Simon made an effort to get a lot of those musicians on tour with them and things like that. But I don't know if that's what people necessarily took away.
There's an amazing...
Everyone thinks Chevy Chase was the big collaborator. And
yeah. There's an amazing compilation album called The Indestructible Beat of Soweto from 1985 that has a lot of that South African stuff and that, and a lot of Muskanda and Mokwanga.
Is that how you're pronouncing
classics.
It?
That's, yeah, well...
I'll fudge it.
But I'd recommend that record. And then there's a whole... Oh, what's the name of it? There's a series of compilations of like South African 70s and 80s jazz and disco stuff that I was listening to a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
And it's fucking amazing.
It's actually like the South African... The African... The various genres seem to be really defined by some amazing compilations. I know Dave Warner, my man Dave Warner, he's a big fan of Ethiopian jazz, of all things. And there's some really legendary compilations on that side of things as well. So yeah, it's definitely worth checking a number of these out, especially if you're a drummer looking for new ideas and you want to steal from oppressed peoples. Just
yeah, it's ideal.
Easy pickings.
Definitely.
Yeah. So I guess
we never. Thanks for that.
We never. Yeah, I know. Sorry. So that was my white guy synopsis of the
history of African music.
The continent that spawned all human life. You are welcome.
Colonizers corner.
Next up. So can we drift into the Nexus at this point? Do you guys have anything?
I have a Nexus. If you get a Nexus, Dave?
I don't have a Nexus.
Oh, it's
at the moment, but I'll see if I can do a Nexus by the time you do.
David doesn't have a Nexus, so this episode is going to be half an hour shorter than usual.
I'll source a Nexus right now.
All right, well, Mark, do you want to go first while David's opening windows?
Only if you play a theme tune.
Right, okay. And I'm going to try and make it thematic without being patronising.
Incidentally, what was up with that last one?
What was wrong with that?
Was it them cheering up or something?
I was in a bad mood. It was a high school band attempting to play Alone and Easy Target.
Yeah, it sounded sounded like a band cheering up.
It was exactly that. Anyway, here's my version for this week, and please somebody send some music in, please. God. I'm going to just start repeating them.
You should. Yeah, mine's actually quite easy, I guess. Meryl Garbo.
No way. Mark's is quite easy, Dave.
Oh, that's unlike it. That's a rare turn up for the
beat. Wait a minute. Is it quite easy and quite short?
It's quite short, aye. But it's interesting. Really? I think it's interesting.
Wait a minute. I'm struggling to comprehend this.
I'm thinking it's interesting.
Right, okay. Cool. Can you maybe just say it really slowly to drag it out a wee bit okay. longer then?
So, Meryl appeared.
Now you're just talking like Dave. See, for the listeners, by the way, see, when I do the edits every week, I cut about 20 minutes of silence out from between each of Dave's syllables.
I'm from the Highlands, I can't help it.
It's the fastest sentence you've ever said.
Meryl appears on a record or a recording created by the Preservation Hall Jazz Band from New Orleans. Who appeared on the TV series and on the record Sonic Highways by Foo Fighters.
Is that it?
That's it.
Could you not even have had the decency to do what Dave does and kind of take the long way around, even if you knew where you were going?
Nah. Because it's about 6 degrees separation, man. Fastest route always wins. Fact.
This is meant to be entertaining.
It is entertaining.
Well.
Fuck you.
The numbers don't show it. I blame our startlingly slow progress on your Nexus. Anyway, Tune Yards worked with a director called Boots Riley. Fucking killer name.
Oh, so
name,
you're going that route then, okay.
Killer name. Worked with a director called Boots Riley on a film called Sorry to Bother You.
Side note, we've played the Coop a few times during the hip hop part of our club night.
Cool.
Which Boots Riley is obviously in. So.
Obviously. Sorry to Bother You, ironically somewhat, is about a black kind of telly salesman who adopts a white accent in order to succeed.
I haven't seen it yet, but I really want to see it. I fucking love the guy, the son of who's also in Atlanta.
Well, it stars Danny Glover.
Okay.
Who's getting too old for this shit.
He is getting too old for this shit.
And Danny Glover, as you probably know, was also an abusive husband in the film The Color Purple.
He was, yes.
Oprah Winfrey and also Whoopi Goldberg, but I could have gone the Whoopi Goldberg is in Star Trek, but we did the Star Trek link last,
you know.
So I decided, too easy.
And Star Trek fans would lampoon you for that because that's a different series of Star Trek.
Yeah, but then I would just have used the crossover episodes.
I don't think, are there any episodes of Star Trek Voyager that Whoopi Goldberg are in?
That's why Deep Space Nine was made, so that it can have one, like Worf crosses over into Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, but Voyager took place away from everything else. We're not talking about this.
Yeah, but Janeway was, don't step to me in Star Trek.
That's not what we're talking about.
Go back to your fucking furry little toys in Star Wars. Toys.
I fucking hate Star Wars.
Ah, alright, okay. I didn't know that. Anyway, so Oprah, who was in The Color Purple, also endorsed and is friends with a certain ex-president, Barack Obama.
Who's he?
He is a Kenyan man.
All right, okay.
who tricked his way to the presidency in the USA, if you are to believe, the current president of the
USA.
So
that's the opposite of Tune Yards.
Yes.
And taking African influences.
Barack Obama is the anti-Tune Yards. If you take a picture of Barack Obama, put it in Photoshop and click invert.
He's a white man.
There she is.
And as we are well aware, Barack Obama was interviewed
appeared
by Dave
on
Grohl.
In utero.
What? Was in the band Garbage. No, Barack Obama was interviewed by Dave Grohl for the show Sonic Highways.
Oh well,
okay. Same like it's me almost.
Yeah. Yeah,
I've got a simple one. Well, it's fairly simple. Water fountain from their third album, Nicky Knack, appeared on the soundtrack to FIFA 15.
FIFA 15. I looked into this and I couldn't find anything, so I'm interested to see where you go with this.
Well, appearing on the UK cover of FIFA 15 is Lionel Messi, four-time Ballon d'Or winner. And
obviously he would have met Chouinard during that process.
Yeah, and they all get together.
I mean, do you remember giving me shit last week for?
And also, I'm doing this right now. I just did this one right now. And also Eden Hazard, Chelsea and Belgium attacking.
I swear, I left them by the river.
Oh dear. Eden Hazard scored against West Ham on the 4th of March 2015.
That's incredibly specific.
It was Sam Allardyce said it was offside, but I'm not sure.
Big Sam. Where is he now?
Apparently, according to Newsweek, Dave Grohl is a fan of West Ham United.
Okay.
So there you are.
So Dave Grohl likes football violence.
Do you think he's a fan of West Ham because of he's a fan of Alan Maton?
Maybe.
Could be.
And Russell Brand, he's a West Ham fan.
Is your man from Napalm Death, Barney, not a... No, it's Villa. He's a Villa fan.
He's Aston Villa. From Birmingham.
Speaking of football links to Dave Grohl, I need to chuck this one in here. Peter Cech is a drummer.
Yeah, I know.
And there's a YouTube video of him playing Foo Fighters songs.
Is that true?
On drums, that's true.
Fuck, man, you should have used that and kept that. Or kept that then used it. Whatever the best sequence is.
Alright, okay, there we are.
Well, that went well. I'll play some,
let's play it again.
Play some outro music and then we can get back to this fucking part. So, one other thing we missed is that Meryl Garber has taken a fair bit of pointless shit for her androgyny and her perceived sexuality. There's a sort of slightly badly misfired article by the writer Chuck Klosterman from like 2012, I think it was. Klosterman's actually a pretty decent writer.
Yeah, he's a pretty decent writer.
And he's just a little bit of a fucking...
Wise-ass.
Yeah, he's just a little bit of a smart-ass. That's probably a better way to put it. And though I get some of his observations regarding the marketing of Chouinard's, I think his comments about our image are unnecessary. But yeah, there you go. He did, however, raise one really interesting point in that article, which is to compare Chouinard's potentially, should they not succeed, to a show called Cop Rock. Have you ever heard of Cop Rock?
I've heard of Cop Rock, yes.
No.
David, you're welcome. Because I looked it up this week. Holy fucking moly.
What is it?
Imagine a mixture of like Law and Order, NCIS and Hill Street Blues, a weekly cop drama that is a musical. Where when for example, in one of the best clips, when this street gang of young African-American hoods get locked up, they immediately get stuck straight into a sort of NWA type rap with the cops in the station all just kind of looking at them and watching them in a sort of it's like West Side Story directed or written by David Simon. It's something special. It was meant to run for 16 episodes. It only ran for 9, but has now become like this incredible cult slow grower.
TV Guide ranked at number 8 on the list of 50 worst television shows of all time.
It's really fucking interesting. So,
the periodical dubbed it the single most bizarre TV musical of all time.
They're totally earnest in it as well. See, when they start singing, the cops are like, it's not like everybody's like clapping and jumping up on tables and the lights go up and stuff. It's just like they try to pretend that nothing's happening. It's really strange.
But the final episode featured Sheryl Crow appearing as a backup singer.
Oh, God, that's pretty good, eh?
There you are.
Brilliant.
There's probably a Nexus in there in future.
Thought that was definitely worth, a Nexus that was worth throwing in there. So we talk about this album just very quickly. Yeah.
It's nice. There's nice songs on it, and that it's very pleasant.
You know what? There's a weird thing about this album, and it's something that I think I really like about it, and one of the things that appealed to me. I get it's much more produced. I get it's much more pitchfork. I get it's much more indie and hipstery, but there's something about it that reminds me of the song "Closed Caption" by Fugazi. Everybody wants their own damn station. If we're so fine, maybe you can tell me why. No one counts until they're dead. That blend of like slightly African rhythm, the innovative use of the guitars in it, the really interesting percussion, and I think that's partly why I found it very endearing. Albeit I think the Cassie were a lot more tactful and didn't, you know, come straight out of the box singing in Jamaican accents, but I do think there's something really nice about it in that sense. And I think if you are a fan of that song and some of that Fugazi era, there's something to be derived from this. The first tune, My Country, as you mentioned, yeah, the opening line is a little bit of a gamble, I'd say, on their part. There's a really nice drop around the minute 40. It kind of drops out and bursts back in. Loads of like really interesting use of horns. There's like glockenspiel. It's just a pretty upbeat, adventurous piece of work. I think it's a good way to set your stall out. It's obviously a lot more hi-fi than the album that had preceded it, and I think people were kind of taken aback pleasantly by that at the time. It's followed by a track called Esso, which, to be honest, actually, funnily enough, so early in it, is actually probably my least favourite song on the album. It's got a kind of weird 30s chic thing.
That kind of annoys me. I was going to say
that was a lot of songs in this record that actually annoy me.
Well, that one I don't love that song. It's my least favourite. It's got a kind of interesting stompy bass line though, and some really interesting guitar stuff in it. There's also kind of a quite an innovative percussive loop in it. But yeah, I mean, I was disappointed that I thought there was a weak link so early in it. But then it goes into like a run of really strong stuff for me. Gangsta, the third song, is a really good song to DJ.
Because everybody knows it from the adverts it's been in.
Well, perhaps, yeah, that does work. I think the groove in it, there's really, really excellent rhythm loop. They do that
the
thing.
The melody is really strong.
It's probably
know,
the
huge,
best melody on the album.
Sort of infectious, sort of major key riff.
Yeah, but the style of the vocals in it, though, I think is one of the ones that is most, inverted commas, offensively.
It sounds like
appropriated.
A black woman.
It really does. And it's gangsta. You know, it's okay, the song is meant to be about white reggae boys, apparently, whatever that is. It's kind of ironic that she's making fun of white guys with dreads when she's so clearly, you know, there's maybe a lack of self-awareness on it.
At what point does reverence become like cultural appropriation?
Well, yeah, the exact same question was asked by a writer around that time as well, reviewing it for, I think it might have been Consequence of Sound, actually. The girl that wrote for that asked that exact question. She's like, where is the, when do you cross over? I don't really know. I think for me, Tune Yards probably does cross over. That's why I'm saying musically, I think this is objectively a very, very good record. I think it's the context of this record that's problematic. Yeah, I mean, there's some cool touches in this song. The woo 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 bit to sound like a police siren is pretty cool. There's really great bass drop at about 2 minutes five, something like that. Although it does have things like a line in it, never moved to my hood.
Yeah.
It just sort of clangs out of the mouth of like a white girl from New England.
It's tone deaf.
Yeah, a wee bit. Track four, Power. It's like a really ukulele led. Starts really smooth and there's a rhythm that comes in. There's a lot of falsettos in it.
Bring
I like this one. It's a bit more laid back, but the tune's really nice. This one actually grew on me quite a bit in the time that I've had this album. I used to sort of skip by it, and now it's one that I'm like really quite into. It's quite atmospheric, but there is a groove in it, and it's probably one of the ones that's got the most genuine soul. It doesn't sound overly it doesn't sound overcooked in that sense. There's a really, really nice use of delayed guitar in it as well. But she's got a hell of a good vocal range as well. I think that's something true. That gets ignored. And she doesn't always use it as much as she probably should. Certainly on her later albums, which are often quite pedestrian, I think like the her range would really have helped those. The fifth track, Riot Riot, it takes about a minute to get going. It's like the most melancholy and sort of slightly uneasy, I think. It's kind of an interesting arrangement. There's some really kind of unsettling chords in the ukulele. There's a bit of piano. It's kind of loungy. There's some kind of loungy drum stuff in it, jazzy.
Me and Dave just looked at each other. Really funny when you mentioned this song. I think you've got something to say about this, because I definitely do.
No, what do you have to say?
This is the most annoying song on the record. It just goes nowhere. My hand is like hell for ages, and I'm like, can you just stop, please? I just don't want to hear this.
It took me, see, when I was like properly listening through it, and I maybe listened through it twice, it took until Business, and it was maybe like the second time I was listening to it, and I listened to Business, and I was like, ah, right, okay, maybe I get it. Maybe I'm starting to understand the record, because everything up until that point, particularly on Right, I was like, this is all very clever, and I know I'm supposed to like it, but it's actually quite annoying me.
So some of the reviews, I mean, even in the Klosterman article as well, he talks about a couple of lines off this as being particularly grating. A couple of the vocal refrains, it's just like really jumping out the mix at him.
And Business as well, the chorus of that just gets him, just rips my knitting.
I don't mind the chorus in Business.
Song,
actually,
man. Business is like a total. Like,
yeah, it was Business that was the
singles.
One that was like, oh, maybe I do like this record.
Yeah.
It's just the way it's said, I think. Just doesn't. Just
I like
really,
really gone. I think that's quite nice and subtle. Which is a problem with this record.
I thought that was kind of like quite. I mean, I like that one, but it's a breather for me. I mean, I think like Business, you can't. I don't want to underemphasize what a standout track that is. That's one that I really, again, I love DJing. It's another single from this. It's one that's really popular live. I love the vocal looping style. It actually, that kind of like almost imitating Jungle Animals vocal looping style is a bit like Adam Stafford, the Scottish musician who does that really, really well. Does like these weird little trills and squeaks and stuff like that that then become quite percussive. There's a really cool bit at minute five where she's doing a high vibrato, and the vibrato is perfectly offset so that it totally syncopates. It's really, really odd effect, but it's cool. There are lines in it. There's a phrase in it like, my wisdom be fighting. I think the very sentence, my wisdom be fighting, is awkward. That's just me, but maybe I'm overanalyzing it, but my wisdom be fighting sounds like somebody trying to sound like somebody they're not. And that's a little bit odd to me. The song, it's got a really euphoric ending though, about 3:40, it just really bursts in. It drops out briefly and bursts in with that. The cascade that's been in it is echoed by other instruments, and it's a really, really, I think, quite a euphoric climax to the song. I like it. Doorstep, track number 7, is the one that's got a really good interest and a really innovative rhythm loop, a kind of 50s style to the vocals, and it's kind of quite upbeat for a song about somebody apparently getting shot by cops, but
yeah.
I'm not entirely convinced about the subject matter in it. But it's a good tune. Track 8, You Yes You, is a bit of a standout for a lot of people. I know that. It's like quite popular live, really vibrant. It's got a cool bass movement in it. It's really upbeat. There's a nice guitar break just before 2 minutes. And there's another really cool vibrato kind of gated vocal at around 2:15 that's just really awesome in headphones as it pans across. It's a really nice production effect. Willy Willy Gong, Dave already mentioned. And then track 10, Killer.
Willy Wally Gong.
Sorry. Willy Wally. Wally Wally Gong.
Willy Wally.
Willy Wally Gong?
Willy Wally Gong.
Willy Wally Gong.
Isn't that fun to say? Ooh, they're so cool. Eccentric.
Track 10, Killer, is I think a really interesting use of like multiple vocals. Ukulele and guitar are pretty prominent, really cheerful. It's a really upbeat ending to the album. Percussion and the bass work really well, and I really like that Watch Me Now, which is quite an understated refrain that closes it in the last minute and a half. I mean, I think it's 10 tracks, it's a succinct album.
It is, yeah. Mercifully so sometimes.
Oh my god, I am taking your fucking lunch money after this podcast, by the way. But yeah, I love the succinctness, the brevity of this album. I think it's really upbeat. It's really different. There's a lot of good ideas in it, albeit I'm not sure if those ideas are necessarily hers. But she's entitled to use them to some extent. As I said in the past, I'm not one that subscribes to that notion that music should be segregated. I do think there is an invisible line that is crossed, though, when you're actually altering your vocal style, altering your vocabulary to sound as though you're not just from somewhere else, you know, be it a middle class person trying to sound working class, but when you're actually trying to sound like you're from a different ethnic background, without
problematic, Chris.
Yeah, it's problematic. Without there being a definitive line that you can point at and say that's the moment, it just feels like it's strayed a little bit too far. Yet on its own merits, I think it's a fucking excellent record. I really enjoy
see,
it.
See, out of context, I think it probably is a really good record, but for me, I think it came out and was interesting and quite influential, along with, you know, a few other artists at that time, you know, like Animal Collective, etc., etc. To me, going back and listening to that 10 years later, maybe it's because it was picked up by adverts and it was used in, you know, mainstream culture quite a lot, or alternative indie culture. It has none of that newness or excitement to me, maybe because I've overheard it in the background of things.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe in 10, 20 years, I'll go back and think, oh, you know, this record stands out as something. But right now, I can't see it out with that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just not sure.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things for me that I admire about this record. I do think that it's very clever. I think the way things are arranged is particularly good. I really enjoy the use of, you know, African instrumentation. And yeah, the vocal thing is kind of annoying, that's definitely true. But again, it comes back to that line, where's reverence and where's cultural appropriation? You know, I don't think there's... I mean, I do think some of our lyrics are tone deaf, and I do think that maybe deploying as much of that, you know, vocally is probably a bad idea, but also on the other hand, how else can you be expected to, you know, use that influence in a kind of, in any other way, if it's... Oh, you know what I mean? It's a really tricky situation, I think.
There probably are better ways to use it, to be in fairness. As much as I really like this album, there probably are more tasteful and discreet ways to show your admiration for styles of music, certainly.
There probably is, but I mean, it's only second record. You still got a lot to learn as a musician, you know, as an artist, how to do that properly, if possible.
It's probably unfortunate for her that her career landed or was on the up during a point in history where these kind of issues gain such prominence.
It's unfortunate for her that she's white.
Perhaps.
I think it's production.
You as well. Think about all the things you could comment on if you weren't white.
Well, yeah, exactly. I know.
The production is a masterclass as well.
The production's tremendous.
It just sounds like nothing else out there, which really jives, which really kind of goes with the vibe of, you know, it being a kind
you're so hip.
I know, but it being kind of a weird and kind of quirky and really interesting listen, but it just doesn't connect with me. And I tried really hard. There's things about it that I like and it made me want to like it more, but the more I listened to it, the more I kind of, I was like, so
I write you a couple of fucking Caucasian motherfuckers, whatever. Right, well, I tell you what, next week we can do something raging and white and metallic. How about that? David, you want to just pull something out the fucking...
All right, let's do something...
thin air.
So white. Let's do Strapping Young Lad.
Oh.
Which album,
why
David?
Why don't we do that? City.
Oh, fucking, you're great at improvising fantastic albums. Fantastic.
It's jazz thought there. That's how I show off my African influences. I
just, all right, Denzel, into, you okay with that?
I'm cool with that.
But okay, yeah, so what, we like this musically. Mark and I get annoyed by it. You still really like it, but they're naive culturally.
Yeah, I think it's worth closer examination.
I think being naive culturally is somewhat forgivable in the context of where this lands in their career. I think maybe making an attempt to address it later on, which as they appear to have done, is a noble thing. But I guess there's better ways to go about all this, you know. And I do think perhaps a lot of the criticism towards it has been quite unfair, like you say, being in the wrong. You can't really be in the wrong time, if you know what I mean, but being in an era where it's a lot more sensitive.
I think she could have kept making the exact same style of music. She just needed to stop singing as though she was...
That's probably one way of doing it, yeah. Mm-hmm.
From a different ethnic background. I think that's just, that's the bit that jars me the most, the lyrics and the style of vocal.
I was thinking about it when you were talking about it earlier on. That's what I was thinking. I was like, well, there's nothing to say you can't use African rhythms and African skills.
No, I mean, quite the opposite. You know, I would say you should. They're fucking tremendous. It's a tremendously fecund musical environment. But I don't think you should take the piss.
Yeah.
There we go. That nail is thoroughly hammered.
There you go.
Yes. So next week, as we say, City by Strapping Young Lad, which is...
I don't think they've appropriated any culture.
Strapping Young Lad. Well, it's the songs. The album's about Tokyo, isn't it?
Well, the album cover is quite Far Eastern and stuff, but also futuristic.
Yeah, it's going to be loud. It's probably the loudest, most saturated album I've ever heard in my life. So
yeah, it'll be interesting to see the waveform on it. It'll just be complete.
We're just going to
square.
For the entire podcast, we're going to scream. If you've seen that, Who's America episode where he gets the guy to shout, use your voice as a weapon, we're just going to scream very mundane sentences, but everything will be gaining, everything
just
will be
as
like
if our scripts are caps lock the entire
exactly,
week.
Yeah, we're going to caps lock on the entire episode next week and we'll pass out and that'll be the end of the episode.
Yeah, it'll be great.
Because of course this is a thoroughly well scripted show.
Yeah. Alright,
so go and vote on Facebook, that'd be awesome.
Tag your friends.
Yeah,
tag your
friends, please. Tell them about how we are, you know, culturally tone deaf as well.
Tell them about how we are just three unfortunate white men doing our bit to try and cover things like Riot Girl and black music. And, you know, we can't help it. As much as we would love to somehow...
Mansplain.
To somehow safely mansplain things. We are men and we're trying to explain, and it's just... it's an unavoidable
consequence.
I'm sorry.
Bye.
Cheers, guys.
You know when you're listening to a true crime story that has an unbelievable plot twist that makes you stop in your tracks? That's what our podcast, People Are the Worst, brings you with each episode. I'm Rachel.
And I'm Rebecca. We're identical twins who love true crime cases that make you say, "Didn't see that coming," and we hate the people responsible for them. Listen to People Are the Worst now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.